How many of you are old enough to remember Tony the Tiger?
What, you mean he's not current?
Remember Frosted Flakes? They're... You all are pretty good at that. Let's try that again. Frosted Flakes, they're... Wow, I like it. They're not just good, John. They're... That was nicely done with a growl, too. I really like that. They're great. Frosted Flakes. Well, I like that word great because we have a great God. A great God, a God who is great and greatly to be praised. And this is a God who makes great promises. How many of you want not just the promises of God, but the great promises of God? Well, I want to talk about that today. I want to read a couple words to you because on that occasion when Abram met God, when God overtook Abram and introduced himself, and of course his name was changed to reflect the character of God and to reflect the promises of God, so the name became Abraham. But when God first introduced himself, he made a promise to Abraham. Actually, he made a handful, a fistful of promises, and they weren't just good, they were great. He said this to Abram. He said, go from your country, from your family, from your father's house to a land I will show you. You see, God is the one who's in charge. God is the one who is going to take him there and to lead the journey. God is the one who can and will make it happen. And then he says this to Abraham, I will make you a great nation, I will bless you, and I will make your name great. Abraham doesn't have to make his own name great. It's not about his reputation. It's about God doing something great in and through Abraham. I will make your name great. You will have a great reputation. Indeed, Abraham has become the father of three different religions, all of which trace their origins back to him. I will make your name great. But the purpose of that is so that Abraham can become a blessing to all the nations of the world. And because we are here today, we are part of the offspring of Abraham, and I believe that those promises still apply, that God still wants to call forth greatness from among his people. We have a great God. Can you catch a glimpse of that? Can you begin to see it? Not just a God or even a good God, but a great God? Can you begin to catch it? And whatever he has for you, it's intended so that he can multiply through you to others, so that his blessing can be released through you. And while it passes through you, don't worry, John, you'll catch hold of it too. That's the way that God works. He works to flow through us to bring his greatness and his blessing to the world. So I want to take you to a story today, and I gave a title to the message. I called it Hagar the Horrible. Some people liked it, but mostly people don't like it, so and have been quick to tell me that. So I'm getting used to that, so I still like the name. Anybody who reads the comic page knows about Hagar the Horrible. It was just one of those fun William. It was a fun play on words. Thank you. So we're going to meet Hagar today, and I just want to tell you a little bit about this story, if I could set the table. We're going to walk through the scriptures, I'll make some comments, and then I'll try to flesh out a message for you that may call forth greatness within the body. Some years ago, I can remember you know another comic strip, Blondie, and of course, Blondie has a husband by the name of Dagwood. And Dagwood, well, he likes to help out. And there are things where that Dagwood just isn't all that good at. He's willing, he's game, he makes an attempt, but sometimes you just need to call the plumber. And so you see the plumber on his back, and you see nothing but the feet sticking out from under the kitchen sink. And there's Dagwood kind of bent over saying, how much if I help you? You know, Dagwood wants to negotiate a deal, you know, bring the price down. I guess plumbers can be kind of expensive. So you just hear a response coming out from under the sink, double if you help. Well, that's exactly the message today. It's a message for Abraham and Sarah. If you try to get your hands on the promise, if you try to get your what you want out of what God said, if you try to help God out, if you think God has been slow or might have forgotten, and you try to push God along, watch out, it's going to cost you double. If you just let things be, they'll be fine. God made a promise. Could I ask you a real simple question? But it affects all of us. Because I suspect some of you have received promises from God that you have not yet seen fulfilled in your life. And you've been waiting and waiting and waiting a long time. Well, with the story that we read today, Abraham and Sarah have been waiting 10 years. That's a pretty significant delay between the time you prayed, God spoke, but you're still waiting to see it come to pass. 10 years, it's a long time. And so these two are getting older. God has promised them a child. It is the promised child. This will be their child. Abraham is moving right along. Sarah now, well, let's just say she's pushing 80, maybe even 90. So things are moving in a direction here where it's too late, humanly speaking. And so it's in the midst of that Sarah and Abraham get a little bit nervous and try to take matters into their own hands. Here's the story. We pick up at chapter 16, the story of Hagar, Ishmael, Sarah, and Abraham. Now, Sarah, Abram's wife, this is before the name change, had borne him no children. She was infertile, incapable of conceiving. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And so Sarai said to Abram, she went to her husband, said, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children." In those days, of course, it was women. If you couldn't conceive, it was always the woman's fault. Of course, today we're a little bit more sophisticated with our medical procedures, and we can see if you need to attribute blame, you can see where the problem might be or where the hindrance is. But either way, she can't get pregnant. And she attributes this theologically to God. She does at least point in the right direction. The Lord has restrained me from bearing children. She knows that it has something to do with God, but she's not pleased about it. That's the flavor that comes through. And she continues, "Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And when you read that story, if your shoulders don't slump, then you're not hearing the reality of the story. She's heartbroken. They want children, especially Sarah, because that's like it or not, that was typically the measure of a woman's worth. If you can't produce offspring, if you can't produce a child, your value is limited. And so Sarah's getting desperate as she ages. She's aging out, and she knows it. The time of expiration is at hand. So she's in her desperation. She conceives of a plan here. And she says, "Please go into my maid, to Hagar. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." If a child was born the way it would happen, and if Sarah were there at the birth of the child, she could claim that child as her own. This wasn't that unusual because it was about getting an heir for the future, even if they had to, even if you had to go by these means in order to get a future. You involved others. It was not a... You and I would be horrified if somebody did that today, but it was acceptable cultural practice in those times, nearly 4,000 years ago. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarah. How do you like that? Does this not sound like Adam at the beginning, listening to his wife Eve? "Here, take and eat the fruit." And Adam should have been strong enough to resist and saying, "No." And here's another man who steps back, becomes a little passive. Okay, he wimps out at the very point where he should have spoken up and said, "No." He listens to the voice of the Holy Spirit, the voice of the angel of God. He listens to his wife, Sarah. Tell me, gentlemen, how many of us haven't done that when we should have been a little stronger? Okay, all right, I'm getting in trouble here. Help me out, Ray, please. Yeah, okay, stop, Jeff. Here we are. You all are enjoying this, aren't you? Well, anyway, Abram, he goes along with it. And I'll even push the boundaries further. Ooh, okay, Sarah. What a plan. I like it. Well, come on. You know, you can't tell me that Hagar might not have been attractive. Abram might have noticed that, but he would never have gone in this direction. But now that Sarah suggests it, well, I thought you'd never ask. Abram's in big trouble, and so am I, right behind him. So Abram heeded the voice of Sarah. And then Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, shoves her into the tent, gave her to her husband Abram, and said to her husband Abram to be his wife. Well, this is an upgrade in classification for her. She's still a slave. Don't forget that. But she's to become a wife now. But she is not the primary wife. And so after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, that's how old the original promise is. And it's still in Abram's pocket. He should have been able, Sarah, look, there's no expiration date on this. I've got it right here from God. This is what he spoke. That's why I asked you, does God change his mind? We just don't want to wait long enough sometimes. Sometimes right before the dawn, just before the sun rises and the promise is realized, we turn away. So actually, I think they postponed it about another 15 years was the result of this. But they don't know that. At this point, it's 10 years, the promise is, 10 years old, and they're nervous. And so, verse 4, so he went into Hagar, and she conceived. Wouldn't you know it, she becomes pregnant. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. In other words, Hagar, now that she's a wife, her status has changed, she also is able to conceive, and she looks at Sarah with scorn and contempt. And why wouldn't she? She's been used, and she knows it. And she's angry. But as a slave, what are you going to do? You have to go along with it. She doesn't have much choice, but she doesn't have to like it, and she's not able to conceal it. It's written all over her. So why should we be surprised that she despises her mistress, Sarah? And then Sarah said to Abram, my wrong be upon you. Suddenly she becomes jealous when she sees what's happening. She doesn't like the result at all. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. Oh, Sarah, you didn't see that coming, did you? You got what you wanted, but you didn't want what you got. You had no idea that things would go awry when you got your hands on this. When you tried to manipulate the situation, help God out, get your hands in there, suddenly things didn't go the way that you hoped. And the Lord judge, says she, Sarah, to her husband, the Lord judge between you and me. See, she's angry at whom? At Abram, her husband. She's furious with him. So Abram said to Sarah, indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please. What do you think about that? Well, Abram, once again, doesn't come off looking very strong. He's a little passive. He actually does do one thing right, though. It's an emotional triangle. He's caught, and he's trying to extricate himself. It's too late, but he does get out of this when he says, no, I want no more of this, Sarah. You do with your maid what you want. He does manage to break out of the emotional triangle there, but it doesn't help Hagar. And when Sarah dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. So Hagar decides to run away. And now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness. This is the first visitation of an angel, a messenger of the Lord, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarah's maid. Ouch. He doesn't just say Hagar. He defines her in relationship to the mistress. There's still a servant master relationship here. And that's the way she's addressed. Sarah's maid. Ooh, it's about the role. At least he knows what her name is. And where have you come from? And where are you going? That's a good question. She's running away. She has no idea where she's going. She's just running away, trying to put the pain behind her. Have you ever tried to run away from your problems? Did that ever really work for you? And it won't this time. In fact, it's actually God, the angel of the Lord, who comes after her and kind of like, nope, nope, you can't run away from your problems. She's running away, but she has no idea where she's going. It might be different if she were running towards something like the promise of God, but she's just running away. She's scared. She's hurt. She's breaking. She said, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarah. And the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress. And doesn't that sound like God? Really, doesn't it? God is the one who sends us directly into our worst fears. He says, you have to cope with this. You have to deal with it. You have to face them. God will not allow us to run away from our fears. Not even Hagar here. He refuses to let her do what she wants. She would like to run. God said, no, back you go. And also he provides, and we're about to hear what he's willing to do. Submit yourself under her hand. Are you kidding me? It's awful. It is. And then the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly. Now there's a promise. Who would have anticipated this on the horizon? I will multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they shall not be counted for multitude. There will be so many of them. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child. And you shall bear a son, you shall call his name Ishmael, which means, by the way, he hears, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He hears, he gets it, he sees her condition. He shall be a wild man. This translation, what's that mean? Some translations say it this way, he will be a wild ass of a man. And so he was. It also means that he's going to live in the wilderness. He's going to be a nomad, a Bedouin. He will wander. That's the kind of man he will be. And about his character, his hand shall be against every man and every man's hand against him. Why? I don't know. That's just the way it is, the way God speaks it. I don't know why. I'd like to ask him sometime about that. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. There will be many of them. And then she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. She's the first one. Well, she does actually have an opportunity, and she names God, which is pretty powerful, quite unusual. And for a woman to do this, this is extraordinary. You are the God who sees. The name there would be Elroy. Now, the Hebrew writers of the scriptures never did much with that. El Shaddai is a name for God. But they didn't do much with this one. But on this occasion, she identifies this one who comes to her as the God who sees, which is to say he sees her plight, her condition, he knows. He's making a promise indicating that he will provide and care for her. And so I'm just going to stop there. Well, imagine this as a scenario for a moment. It's not uncommon in our world for a couple to have dreams or to have a dream about having children, children of their own. But as some of you know, some people aren't blessed with fertility. They can't conceive, and no child is on the way. Fertility tests may indicate on a particular occasion that the wife is the one who can't conceive. And so I can just imagine Elisha thinking to herself, why me? Why me, God? What's wrong with me? Because some couples that she knows, well, other couples, they don't even want children. They're so into their professions, their careers, they are pursuing interests of their own. And there are others who don't want to bring children into a world the way it is. But Elisha has always wanted to have children of her own. And it may not be the best theology, but Elisha has an emotional reaction. God, what did I do wrong? Is it something I did? Is there something wrong with me? Why are you punishing me? I wonder how many times we've wondered, you and I, when we don't get what we hope for, what we dream of, we attribute that to God. We ask, Lord, is there something wrong with me? We tend to think it's us, we who are responsible. So every time Elisha and her husband Bill were invited to a baby shower, every time they got a birth announcement, any time they went to church and ever watched an infant baptism, they felt it, the pain, the agony, like the stab of a knife. And then one day, Elisha was at the supermarket, and she just saw one of those tabloids there as she was getting ready to check out, and she saw a headline, surrogate motherhood. And she thought, oh, that's crazy. I could never do that. But the idea was embedded, it was planted, and she began to think about it. Well, you know, maybe. And the more she thought about it, the more it began to work on her and to appeal to her. And finally she thought, you know, at least I'm going to have my husband, and maybe with Bill's participation. And no, it wouldn't be my womb, but it would be our child, and I would love that child like that child is absolutely my own, just like my own. So she approaches her husband, Bill, and he at first is a little bit resistant. Initially, he's like, I'm not so sure about this, but slowly begins to warm to the idea. They do their homework, a little research, and ultimately they discover a willing candidate. A woman who's healthy, already has two children of her own, who's willing to do it financially, what they offer to her, $25,000, will help meet some of her needs. And so it seems like a win-win situation for everybody involved. And immediately after that, the trouble begins. Because soon after she's inseminated, she becomes pregnant, and in about 2 months, everybody can tell a child is on the way. And so Bill, he began to visit her daily just to make sure that she was okay, in case there's anything that she needed, something to eat, making sure that the baby is safe and well, the child that's on the way. They have her over for dinner. She eats with them frequently. And Bill raves about the baby. Can't just imagine what it's like to become a father in the future. I can't wait to be a dad. And he didn't notice, but his wife Alicia was just growing quieter and quieter as she saw Bill, her husband, and this other woman laughing about the child on the way. They laughed and laughed, and she retreated further and further away. And one night, she just exploded at her husband. She accused him of having an affair with a woman, of ignoring her, of being inconsiderate and an absolute jerk. And so Bill, well, he didn't see this coming, so he reacted rather defensively. And he said, "No, no, Alicia, I love you very much. But the only reason I spend so much time with a woman is because I want to make sure that the baby's well, that everything's going to be fine." And finally, he just looks at her, gets a little disgusted, and he says, "Alicia, why don't you just grow up? This was your idea in the first place." Well, Bill, not helpful. Things aren't going so well. So she looks at Bill rather coldly. She glares at him, and she said, "Bill, I want you to make sure this baby gets aborted. I want nothing to do with this child. You will never bring this child home to us." Well, at that point, what they didn't know is that the woman, the surrogate mother, had left her purse at the house, so she had walked in the door and heard most of the conversation. And when she heard this, she just picked up her purse and fled. She left a note in the mailbox that said she would be in touch. They found out later that she had moved to another city where her parents lived. They understood later that the child had been born, and as it happened, they did get to see the child, but the woman raised the child as her own child, which indeed the little boy was. They decided that they wanted to call the little boy Abraham, but the woman, the surrogate mother, decided that his name would be Bill. What do you think about a case like that? That's the story of Abraham and Sarah. And Hagar, isn't it really? In contemporary in terms, isn't that really the story? I just wonder if that's not what happens when you and I try to help God out, when we try to take things into our own hands. "I can help you, God." And we're like little children who don't know what they're doing. "Dad, let me do that. I can do that. Let me use the electric saw. I haven't shown you how to do that." "That's okay, Dad. I've watched you. I can do it." And if you're a smart dad, you're like, "I don't think so. Not until we've had a conversation about safety." And so I just wonder if that isn't what happens to us when we try to manipulate, to mold, or to manage circumstances to try to get what we want. "But I want a child, and I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen." And some of us have tried to do everything we can with the opportunities and the methodologies and techniques and tools of the world. We try everything. We beg, we plead, we ask God. And when God takes his good old sweet time, and it seems like God may have forgotten us, we try to help God out just in case God forgot about us. "Well, I can help God out. We'll just try it this way." And we think we're taking a shortcut, but it just backfires. It blows up in our faces because we don't check in with God. We don't consult God. Sometimes I think we want to play God or try to fix the problem or help God out to get the outcome that we want. "But I just want." Well, God knows what you want. He does know. He knows our hurts. He knows our dreams, our ambitions. But when we try to take shortcuts, they often backfire, simply because on occasion we refuse to wait for God. I can't explain it, but from God's perspective, all I can say is that God's ways are not our ways. Why does God take so long? Have you ever wondered? I sure have. You pray and you wait and you wait and you pray some more and you wait some more, and you can wait many, many years, many years for God to answer your prayers. And because it's not on our time schedule, we sometimes wonder if God hasn't forgotten. And sometimes it seems like we just can't wait any longer in the midst of suffering and persecution, oppression, and injustice. So take Hagar, for instance. Look at her story for just a moment. And if you look at the story, you get a revealing glimpse into a window into what it was like to be a woman in the 19th or 20th century BCE, before Christ, before the Common Era. What it was like for women in the Bible long ago. Women were considered what? Property, chattel. You're right, Bernie. Women were considered to be property. First, they were the property of their fathers, and then they were given in marriage to a husband. And so they became then the property of the husband. And not surprisingly, if you read know more about the story of Abraham and Sarah, Sarah gets handed off a couple times by Abraham. She gets handed over to Pharaoh, and later on, in order to safeguard Abraham's life, she gets handed over by her husband to King Abimelech, all because Abraham can't quite bring himself to speak the truth, because he doesn't step forward trusting God or to protect his wife. He lets her down a couple times over, he does. And so what happens is that Sarah's body is violated because that's less important than the safety of Abraham. And this is what it was like to be a woman in those days. And so as it happens, Sarah is told by Abraham, you just tell them that you're my sister. Was that true? It's true. They had the same father, but it's not all the truth. Abraham conceals the rest of it. It's true, but there's more to it. They were also husband and wife, and what he was doing really should not have happened. And so he told Sarah, thank you for this kindness that you have done. But it put her in a terribly vulnerable position, a risky position. And the truth is that her husband didn't speak up for her. No wonder, you look at the story later on, we're going to find out, do you think Abraham and Sarah had a great marriage? Well, you read the story and the way it plays out, there was a lot of drama involved. It was a pretty messy marriage that they had together. And I think it could have been a lot different, perhaps, if Abram had just been strong from the beginning and said, Sarah, we're not going to do this. But he was passive, and he wimped out and perhaps stepped back. At the very point where he should have trusted the promise of God, he failed, and he didn't protect her. So twice over, two strikes against Abraham for that. So Sarah was expected then to obey Abraham in all things. And I don't know why it is, but the worth of women was measured against their ability to produce heirs. Has anybody been watching that PBS special about Queen Victoria? If you've watched a little bit about that, part of the story is, of course, what do they want the queen to do? To produce an heir. It matters. Produce an heir, preferably a boy. Thank you very much. But it hasn't changed all that much in many ways for women. So infertility, today we know better, but in those days, whose fault was it? And they had to blame somebody, right? Whose fault was it? It's always the wife's fault. It's always the woman's fault. And so here comes Sarah, and she's desperate for a son. Infertility was viewed, furthermore, as a sign of God's rejection, disfavor. Clearly, Sarah, you did something wrong. You're at fault here, and you need to figure out what it is. And so I can see why Sarah, in desperation, say, well, maybe if my maid Hagar gets involved, we'll get a son that way. I mean, you can understand. What's so sad about this story is that here are two women who might have become allies against an oppressive system if they had teamed up together and said, we're not doing this. But instead, each one has a little power. They each vie for their little piece. And instead of allying themselves to overthrow an unjust system, what happens? Sarah and Hagar become enemies. And so the whole thing continues, sadly enough. So here you get this whole sad story about horrible Hagar. Or maybe we should say horrible Sarah or horrible Abraham, because they all are. Except for one thing. God gets involved. God is not afraid of what happens. He's not afraid to get involved with human beings and to mix it up. The promise of God is still on track. Although they've thrown a monkey wrench in the works just a little bit, God shows up and he takes an interest. And this is the first time that an angel of the Lord appears to someone, and it's to Hagar, the slave, who's been used and abused by everyone, and it's to her that the messenger of the Lord appears. And I think you could sum it up this way: God hears the name of Ishmael. You shall call the name of your son Ishmael, because it means God hears. God has heard you. He sees your condition. He knows and he cares. And God offers a promise. And he too will become great, a multitude. You see God's blessing? Well, there is a blessing in it, but there sure is a lot of tension and conflict, because the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Abraham, are they still fighting today? All throughout the Middle East. So there are consequences that have reverberated for nearly 4,000 years, echoing across history and all the generations. Don't think for a moment that there weren't consequences that affect world history today, all because of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar too, all because of what they did and didn't do, and because of the way that they didn't trust God. All I can say to you is that Hagar is a victim of race, class, and gender. But God isn't finished, because he's not put off by her race, her class, or her gender. And so I think what we can say is that the covenant of faith is available to anyone and everyone who simply will trust the promise of God. God rolls up his sleeves. He's not finished yet. He hears, he sees, and he says, you know, Ishmael will also be a child of promise. However, he pivots in the very next second and would say to Abraham and Sarah, but he will not be the promised child. Yes, Ishmael will be a child, a promised child, but he will not be the one that I'm talking about. My promise is right on track, still on the way. So what you look at, our takeaway from the story, I think, is that God cares and cares deeply. And it's not over, it's never over until you've heard from God. I think that's what the story says. Until you've heard from God, you haven't heard the last word. It messes things up when we try to manipulate and get what we want, or even to manipulate God. But God, you know how much I want this. I know you want me to have my dreams. Really? I think sometimes God is a lot more interested in what he's doing than he is our comfort. It wasn't comfortable for Hagar to be sent back to the master. So God is still at work in powerful ways, because God is not our servant. Do things your way, and I think what you discover is that you will get what you deserve and what you earn as the natural consequences of what you and I do. And God will let us, how many of you know that God will let us do what we want? There's a point at which God will just take his hands off. Okay, you don't trust me? You want to do it? Go ahead. See how that's working for you. And for some of us, we have the stories to tell of how it went for us. You look behind like the tail of a kite and you say, oh my goodness, I can't believe I did that. Retrospect, looking in hindsight, 2020, we can scratch our heads and say, why was I so foolish? Am I the only one like that? Why did I do those things? Why did I not trust? I know I'm probably the only one, but you all get to kind of smile, right? So I think most of us actually do know what I'm talking about. So I just ask you that one question again. Does God change his mind? The promise of God is still in effect in spite of what Sarah has done, what Abraham agreed to, and what Hagar couldn't resist. The promise of God is still on track. God promised Abraham something, and what was it? Greatness. Your name will be great, Abraham. And he promised him a great name and a great nation and a great future through his own son. Abraham, and we're not finished with him, we're going to be back to look at him. He's looking at Ishmael as if that's the son. God is saying no, but Abraham, is hearing God but looking at Ishmael. We'll see what happens with that. Here's what I want to say to you today. Please, whatever happens, don't settle for a surrogate. Don't settle for a substitute. Don't swap the promises of God to get your hands on it. Let me help God. I know what to do. I know what I need. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, I don't. We don't. But But how many of you can believe that God's best is still ahead for you? Can you believe in greatness? You know, what seemed good to Hagar or to Abraham perhaps or to Sarah, well, it might look good, but that's not what God is doing. It might look okay, but God is looking for greatness, something more than that. I can imagine God just like, don't settle, no, don't do that. That I had something so much better for all of you than this. And we say, that's okay, I know what I'm doing. Do you? Greatness. Turn to somebody else next to you and say, God has something great for you. Do you believe it? Do you believe it? That God has something great for you. Thank you, Tim. I just want you to go away, not feeling bad, but let me ask you a question. Some of us have settled for Ishmael. Where's your Isaac? God's still saying, wait a minute, wait for it, John, wait for it. Your Isaac is on the way. Wait for it. Wait upon me. Wait for it. Where's your Isaac? God wants to bestow greatness on you in order that others might be blessed. Hagar looks cursed to me, but God wants to bring a blessing. And in spite of what happened to her, God still blessed her, provided for her, and gave an extraordinary future to her son. God notices these things, and he has his ways of working things out providentially. Greatness. Can you believe God for the great things that he still promises and yearns to do?